Hi, welcome to The Left Brain Artist. I'm Suzanne Redmond. Today's interview is with artist Beverly Ash Gilbert. Beverly lives near Seattle, Washington, with her family and spends part of her time at Whidbey Island in Puget Sound. I first met Beverly over 10 years ago when I took one of her jewelry making classes. While her artistic medium has changed to fiber arts and painting, she is still teaching students how she uses color in every aspect of her life. She's written 5 books, and she tells us about how she created the first book and why she chose to self-publish some of them. I think you'll learn a lot from our conversation, as she has accomplished so much with her artwork, books, and teaching. This is Beverly Ash Gilbert. Hi, Beverly. Thanks for joining me today.
Hi, how are you?
Good. It's so nice to see you. I'm speaking with Beverly Gilbert, and she and I have been friends for quite a few years because I went out to Portland, Oregon when she was teaching a class and took a jewelry class from her. And then, as I recall, later in the week, we were attending a class together, and it was with Lisa Kaus, and we sat together. And I've also been out to her home on Whidbey Island. She lives near Seattle, but then has a home on the island as well. And she teaches classes, retreats there. So we'll talk about that as we get further into our conversation. So Beverly, I'd like you to start by just telling me what type of art that you do, because when I met you, it was as a jewelry artist, but you are so much more than that. So tell us about your art.
Thank you. I consider my medium to be color. The actual materials that I grab could be beads, or they could be flowers, or right now I've been really launching into fiber art, Nuno felting specifically, and as well acrylic painting. I do photography. I'm very attracted to playing with color and using unique colors together. I try not to stick with the same color palette, so it's always something that is a challenge to me and very, very fun.
That's great. When did this come to you in your life? Did you always be a follower of color, even when you were in school?
So interestingly, my background is actually engineering. I have a master's in engineering. and it wasn't until I had kids and I was able to stay at home, that I could launch into pursuing art. And when I look back, I remember as a little teeny girl taking out those Crayola crayon boxes, you know, the 64 colors.
Yeah.
And in those years, they were named yellow, orange, and orange, yellow. They weren't named, you know, peach or mandarin orange. And I would create all of these color wheels and rainbows of every single color. I'd place them in order of how they were created, right? So yellow, orange next to orange, yellow next to, et cetera.
So you were making your own color wheels?
Yeah. And so color always grabbed me. My grandmother was a fabulous quilter, and color was always her expertise.
Oh, okay. All right.
A lot of time together.
Yeah. And when I met you, it was around the time we're going to talk about all your books. You have so many wonderful books that you've written, but your Beaded Colorways, and of course, that was the book we were kind of using in the jewelry classes that I took with you. What was fascinating to me was how you expressed a color wheel, but colors that were right next to each other and how well they go next to each other, as opposed to how well they blend with each other, because of course you can't blend a blue bead and a red bead. But that's interesting to hear you talk about your grandmother's quilts, because it's the same thing. You're not blending the fabrics together.
Right.
Yeah.
So Beaded Colorways came out just after I published Eye for Color, which is a color wheel system.
Yes.
And I created Eye for Color because I was teaching some color classes at the Bead and Button Show, as well as Art and Soul Festival that I met you at.
Okay.
And when I went to find some color wheels that I could use as a tool for my class, I realized that most color wheels out there are for painters. And like you said, it helps you to, you know, realize that, gosh, blue and mixing with yellow makes green. Or if you mix that with some red, you get some complex earthy tones. But yes, doesn't show you or isolate for your eye how well different color combinations go together. And for bead artists and floral designers, gosh, I've even sold Eye for Color to the theater world in creating costumes.
Yeah,
you want to, perhaps you have a color palette that you're working with and something just isn't popping. You need to visualize what colors might be added to that so that it creates a more exciting color palette. And that's when I created the Eye for Color system. It has a number of color wheels, saturated and pastel. I have add-ons that are in earth tones. And then there's different templates that block out and open up windows for different yummy color combinations.
Right. And you have the actual color wheels as a pull out in a pocket that you can pull out from the book and use it
right
for your artwork. Yeah, I love that.
Right. You snap them onto the templates and you can kind of spin the templates around and see what color combinations you want to work with. Yeah.
Okay.
And then I actually used Eye for Color as a reference point when I wrote Beaded Colorways. So that book was specifically for beads and it was more freeform bead weaving and using bead soups. So I used the Eye for Color, the color wheel, to add excitement and energy to the bead soups and in beaded colorways.
Okay, can you explain what a bead soup is? Of course, I know because I have about 30 of your bead soups, but.
Yeah, bead soup would be a collection, and in this case, I was specifically using little small seed beads because I was doing bead weaving, which is, you know, with sewing beads together. So bead soups are just a collection of various shapes, sizes, and colors of beads that are pulled together in a way that is visually beautiful, visually a little bit more depth to it than a single color might be.
Okay.
So adding, yeah, so just a mix of different beads. And you could do the same thing, obviously, with gems or anything else.
Right.
The same philosophy is with any material.
Okay. So what you did is you sold bead soups in these little, what were they, 2-inch by 2-inch boxes?
Right, and right.
And you gave them beautiful names. So you have, I know you have one called Copper Penny. And so
yeah,
the Copper Penny would be copper colored beads, but it would have other colors as well, or
right,
different shades of it. You know, there might be black. There might be.
Right. There might be 20 different beads actually in that, 20 different types of beads in that. Again, different shapes and sizes, different hues, perhaps taking copper and making some darker values, some lighter values, maybe some that lean a little bit more towards orange, some that lean a little bit more towards red, because of course copper is in the orange-red family. It's just
right,
an earthier tone. So, yeah.
So how did that come about that you made a bead soup? Was it to fill a need, something that you were looking for and couldn't find in stores?
Okay, a number. Oh gosh, that's pulling me back a little bit.
I guess so.
I took a class from Nancy Meinhardt, who is a master beader.
Okay.
Years, probably 2003, I think. And she introduced me to the concept of bead soups. She has a beautiful eye for color. And I used to then pull all of these beads together, and I'd have them in separate little piles, and I'd like grab each one and then I'd put them back into their tubes. And she said, oh, no, no, mix them all together and see what happens. And she really opened up an entirely new pathway for me. It was kind of a freedom. I realized that, especially in my engineering years, I was very rigid and left brain and precise. Mm-hmm. And now all of a sudden I could just play. And once I mixed all those beads together, it was a beautiful combination. It was, you know, that synergy thing, better than all the parts.
Okay. All right. That's wonderful. When you made your first book, The Eye for Color, can you tell me about the process that you took to, that was your first book ever. You've never had books before that, right? Okay. What is the process that you took that told you that you could write a book to begin with? That you could even attempt this? Because I know a lot of people, they think they have a book in them, and I'm sure they do, but it takes the really brave person to move forward and create an entire book. So what were your feelings when you started that?
Oh, wow. That's a great question. Eye for Color, I started out thinking it was just a tool. It was simply a tool for my students in a particular class.
Okay. So you had already started teaching beading classes, right?
Oh, yeah. I'd already been teaching beading classes, okay. But I had been accepted to teach a color class at the Bead and Button Show.
Okay.
So not just a bead class or a jewelry making class, but specifically a class that focused on color. As I said, I kind of went around and looked for different color wheels, and I wasn't finding it. And I thought, well, I know what I need.
Yeah.
And I wasn't thinking of this as I'm going to write a book. I was simply thinking I see this need and I know how to fill it, but I don't know how to take it from this painted color wheel that I made with all of these little templates that I'd cut out into a book. Luckily I knew a woman who is also a good friend of mine, who is a graphic designer. And I will never forget that I took it to her. It was, I think, around New Year's, 2008. And I took it to her and I said, gosh, this is what I want to do. She had graphic design background. She also did a lot of packaging, like for Microsoft releases.
Okay.
So, you know, the little packaging that you would put a disc into.
Mm-hmm.
And she said, Beverly, this is more than a tool. So it was somebody else believing, right?
Okay.
She said, this isn't a tool. This is something that I think is going to be bigger than just this class. And so she and I worked side by side. She helped me do the graphic design part of it, the InDesign and the Illustrator part of it, because I didn't know those programs at that time, to basically take this from the concept to publishing.
Okay.
So the book part kind of fell into my lap. It started out as something left.
Yeah, but you had to figure out how to explain this, how to put this into words.
Yeah, yes. And so, but again, it's piece by piece. And I think oftentimes we get stuck, and you and I've talked about this. We get stuck. We have this idea. We know it's a good idea, but we don't know where to start.
Right.
And if we don't know where to start, that project just goes away.
Yes.
It just always gets put off.
Mm-hmm.
And I had a deadline of this class I was teaching on June 1st. And I had found a person that could guide me in knowing how to take it from one step to the next step.
Okay.
And that really, really helped me. And once we, and it was an incredibly joyful process. This was a self-published book, and I actually ended up paying for 2,500 copies printed, which was a huge chunk of money.
Yep.
But at the same time, she was very right. This was much bigger than just this class. In fact, that was 10 years ago when I sell now all over the world this book.
Oh, that's great.
Now, this is a little different than other types of books, because again, this was a tool. I also felt as if I had all these different bead classes that I'd taught, and now in later years, all these different fiber art classes that I'd taught, and all these different color classes that I taught.
Mm-hmm.
Similarly, some people have blogs that they accumulate material in.
Right.
And you start to realize, hey, I kind of have a book here. And
right.
The Beaded Colorways was actually published by Northlight Books. I didn't self-publish that. But the process of going from this conceiving of a book to actually writing it is simply an outline, just like, you know, you do in with anything that you are working on
right.
in high school and beyond. It's
right.
simply an outline. And once you have that outline,
mm-hmm.
then all of a sudden, you know where to start and you know what pieces you need to fill in. And the more detailed that outline, all of a sudden you've got a book.
Right. And like you said, with Eye for Color, you had this woman who you essentially partnered with, who helped you through trying to figure out the mechanics of this and the process. Then when you went with Northlight Books, you had an editor there. So you're never doing a book all by yourself anyway.
I didn't for those two, but all of the last three books have been all myself.
Oh, okay.
Because now I get how to do it. And this is like anything. Once you've done something once, you understand how to do it.
I see.
And I think that first time is really helpful to have somebody guiding you.
Yeah.
And I actually, for anybody, any of your audience that has this little tickle inside that they're looking at maybe creating a book, I have some really great references, and maybe it's something that I could share with you.
Absolutely.
Tanya Jenny was the acquisitions editor for Northlight Books. She's now gone off on her own.
Okay. I was wondering, I was going to ask you about that. Is this Tanya Davenport, and she's has a married name, or she's changed her name? Okay.
She's changed her name. So it was Tanya Davenport. It's now Tanya Jenny.
Okay.
And she has a fabulous e-course on writing your own book.
Oh, that's
and she's
great.
Somebody that I highly recommend looking into her course.
I'll get the information from you and put it as a link in the show notes. So everything we talk about, I'll make sure that people can find it.
Perfect. Because again, I think it's just starting and perhaps giving yourself deadlines. And I've done this with a number of things. Each book that I've written, I start at the end. I decide I want this book to be released in, you know, December of 2020. Okay. I know I need to start the process January of 2019 because it's going to take a year and a half to, you know, write it or whatnot. Right. It's like anything. You have to just start.
Right. Yeah. Yes. And sometimes it is hard to start and make that first step. But I think artists, they work so much by themselves. They work so much alone. And I think you've made a good case for having a partner, having someone who, if anything, it's another set of eyes looking at what you're doing, or someone where you can just bounce ideas off of. But it's also an accountability partner. Yeah, you've had said to that person, they're only one person, but you have said it out loud that I have this, you know, January 2020 date or something. Yeah.
I actually think that is so powerful that I actually, every January 1st,
mm-hmm.
And it doesn't necessarily happen on January 1st, but every new year, I send out there to the world what my intention is for that next year, what I'm going to accomplish. And when I write it out, like send it to my blog or my newsletter.
Okay.
I'm accountable now.
Yeah.
And now I have to do it. Now I have to. I've given myself a deadline. Of course, my readers probably have forgotten, but I have sent it out there, and it forces me to work on it.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah. And like you said, having, I just now finally, after 13 years in the art business, I have finally actually hired some help. Again, I've hired Joey Mooring, who is the woman, the graphic designer that helped me on Eye for Color. Okay. I've hired her to help me with some marketing, and I just totally did my website. And she helped me try and organize and compile all of the different materials that I had. I've accumulated, as I said, I used to do the bead weaving. I also have photography and photography classes. I have paintings, painting classes, fiber art. There was just so much content there.
Right.
And she has really helped me organize it, because there again, once you know what you have to do, you're able to do it.
Yeah. And you know, I'm a big advocate for artists having a website. And I know that the younger artists think I'm old school by saying you have to have a website, and they say, but I have Instagram or Facebook, which is fabulous. Have all those things. But I feel like you need a website as a landing page that can summarize everything that you have, especially someone who has all these extras like books and teaching, and you do gallery shows, and you want to have a calendar on there and announce when you've got a new show or a new retreat coming up, or your online classes are going live on a such and such date. You need one place.
I think that, definitely Instagram and Facebook. Facebook, maybe for an older generation audience, and Instagram for a younger generation audience. They're very, very powerful selling tools.
Yep.
But as you said, they're a little bit more one-dimensional. If you are only a painter and you've just got these paintings that you're trying to sell, then perhaps the Instagram is going to be fine for you.
Right.
But if you decide that you want to submit to a gallery or, you know, a physical brick and mortar gallery, they need to see this landing page. And it is, it's your, like you said, it's your store. And somebody talked about your website is essentially your home.
Yes.
Instagram and Facebook and Twitter, those are all, flags that you're waving at people saying, oh, come into my house.
Right. That's a good way to look at it.
And your newsletter, this is an analogy that Kelly Ray Roberts has talked about a lot, and I really admire her as a businesswoman and as an artist.
Yes.
She talks about your newsletter and your blog. Envision sitting around a kitchen table with each other. And this is sharing the deep, deep stuff, right?
Right.
Mm-hmm. And all of those things are critical for longevity in the art business, I think.
Yes.
You definitely need to get out there and wave and have people come to your home, but you've got to have that landing page if you want to do some e-courses or podcasts like you're doing.
Right.
You've got to have people come to your website and be able to find the content there, also gather a mailing list.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Right. And I think that for the blogs, you know, the word blog kind of gets a negative connotation nowadays, but it's just stories. And so change the title of your blog, the tab at the top of your website, change it to stories, and then people don't think negatively about it. But I think that especially with art, because art is such a personal thing, that the person who is buying art wants to know the artist. They want or feel that they know them. And so they want to hear these stories, and they want to know that yes, I'm selling this fiber art, but I have this history of working with color and analyzing color. And that makes it more interesting to the buyer to know that about you.
And not just that, not just the interest, because you're right, but it's also the credibility.
Yes.
I've had a number of buyers who think about things for a while. Art is not necessarily something that people buy spontaneously, especially like my paintings are fairly large and they're very pricey. And a person isn't going to necessarily buy a 2-foot by 3-foot or 4-foot painting if they don't have the space, right? It's something that they really think about. They have to decide.
Mm-hmm.
It's my investment. You know, I spend $1,000. I want to make sure that this is a painting that I'm going to love. And so it's something where they need to be able to come back to, and they also need to know that you are credible, that if they buy this painting from you, it is as gorgeous as it looks online.
Yes, right.
And that there are, that it's kind of like, I don't want to call it a resume, because that's kind of, and that's too engineering, that's too business-like, but I have had a number of people ask me, well, what galleries are you in? What, where do you sell your paintings? And because they're trying to figure out whether you are, collectors especially want to figure out whether you are just flying through this and this is a one-time thing, or whether you actually have a body of work that, is of high quality.
Yes, I agree. And when you're talking about body of work and talking about a website as a, the website is the history of what you've done. So I think it's very important to include paintings that have sold on your website, because it shows yes. people that you've sold. It shows people that your style has evolved over time. And I think that's yes. important for artists.
Yes.
You do need to respond to what the market wants. If they want the same thing for 20 years from you, that's okay too. But I think you need to show your history on the website.
I do. I think, I mean, a lot of people get into the, you can go the other direction and show too much of your history.
Oh yeah. You can't show everything.
And I've learned that keeping an old painting on just because I want to honor I want to personally honor its past is not the right motivation.
Okay.
I want to really just show the works that are good.
Okay.
So mm-hmm. some of my work that is, I want to make sure. In fact, I just got accepted into a gallery last night.
That's great.
and they are going to go back and look. And if they see work on there that is not all that great, that's going to put a negative, you don't want them to go and see anything on there that you aren't really proud of.
I understand. Right. Yes. Yeah. So you are honoring what you are selling right now by showing paintings of the same caliber or the same style.
Yeah.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. But even so, I mean, I definitely have paintings on there from, you know, 5 years ago,
mm-hmm.
But maybe just not some of the paintings that weren't fabulous.
Right. Yes. Because as artists, we do have occasionally some that aren't fabulous.
Right.
Yeah. Okay. So let me go back to talking about your classes that you teach. When you went to the Bead and Button show, which is a huge show, it's over a few days and it's once a year, right? Or is it a couple times a year?
Yeah. Now yeah. I haven't taught, actually. I kind of retired my bead business,
yeah.
My beading side of business. But that, yeah, that was intense. It got to the point where each year, I think I taught from 2005 to 2011 there every
That's
year.
That's a long time. Yeah.
A long time. And I think if I were 10 or 15 years younger, I could probably still do it.
Yeah, that's a marathon of a time period, or the days that you're up there. It's hard work.
It's hard work. I was teaching each time that I would do it each year. I would teach, I think 7 to 8 classes, and they were always stuffed. There were maybe 20 people in a class. And of course, teaching is fabulous, but it is exhausting because,
yeah.
as you know, you have to be upbeat and on. It is a really It's exhilarating and I love teaching, but after I teach, I do need a little downtime.
Yeah.
And when you're teaching for 7 or 8 days straight, oh gosh, I would just be, I wouldn't have any energy left.
Oh gosh.
So, that's fun. Yeah.
So what is the process to get into something that large? Do they have an application procedure?
Yeah.
And do you have to have already shown them that you have a history of teaching that type of class?
No. So I started teaching a couple of classes at a local bead store.
Okay.
And one of the students said, you know, I just came back from the Bead and Button show. And she said, you are a better teacher than the ones that I had there. And I love your class. And she said, you should apply.
That's great.
And I thought, what the heck? I have nothing to lose. So I made sure that I had fabulous photos of my pieces. Oh, okay. I'm sorry. In those years, you actually sent your piece in. I don't know if you still do or not.
Okay.
Most of the places now that I would teach at, everything's online. But at least in those years, you send the piece in.
Oh boy, that's kind of scary.
It is scary. And with a written up, instructions and, photos and, that part I felt pretty good about because I had been teaching. So,
okay.
You know, if you have not, for any of your listeners who have not yet written up instructions, that's something that you may consider getting help with the first time. Again, once you know how to do it, it's fine. If you even have taken classes and you like the instructions that people write, take note of how they write those instructions. And,
okay.
You know, the one
that's
you
a
like,
good suggestion.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. In fact, I actually have a lot of my old instructions on PDF availability on my website. I think they're each $8.
Oh, okay.
But, it's something if anybody is interested in, you can kind of take a peek at. But yeah, you send it in and it's a juried process. So they have your piece for a couple of months. Oh gosh, I think even more than that. I think we send it in like June or July and they let you know in November. But that's a really huge venue. And I would suggest for those that are just getting started to actually approach their local art centers.
That's a good idea.
Yeah. I taught a lot in the schools as well, elementary schools. So I had a lot of teaching experience before I jumped up to the level of a national venue.
Okay. And at that particular show, did they also have a vendor night where you had the opportunity to sell your bead soups and some other things and books?
Yeah, they do. And most of the big venues will do that. I just taught at a wonderful fiber art venue in Colorado last March, I think it was. And they have one night where the kind of a meet the teachers, meet the instructors. So these were both very different venues. Back in the Bead and Button show days, we were, you know, there's probably 100 different teachers because this is thousands and thousands of participants from around the world. And so we each had our little booth and we had all of our materials there. People would come up to our booth at the fiber arts show. That was more kind of a fireside chat where I was able to stand up and talk to people. And I had some of my books and things, my new Nuno Felt book available. Yeah, most venues will do that.
Yeah, and it's a way to earn more income beyond the class fees.
Yeah. In fact, oftentimes when I'm asked to come and teach, I teach at my local art center.
Uh-huh.
I also, as you mentioned, teach retreats where people come to me and I prepare food and do all of that sort of thing. But one of the very lucrative teaching venues are workshops that are remote from you. And a good venue, and actually the only ones that I will come and teach at anymore, are ones that will pay your transportation and your hotel and your per diem, your meals.
Okay.
And they will pay you a daily fee. You have to watch out because some won't do that.
Is the daily fee dependent on the number of students? So it's higher the more students you get?
It can be.
Okay.
It can be. I have a minimum.
Okay. Okay.
But I've been teaching a lot and I do mm-hmm. have a number of books, so I can actually charge. I won't do it for less than, you know,
a number. Right. And you can command that. And I understand that. Yeah. Yeah, because I know a lot of the teaching, the destination teaching, they don't pay for your airfare and they don't pay for a hotel or a room for you, even if it is at a cute bed and breakfast or something. So you do have to ask those questions.
Yeah. Yes, you do. And I've seen two different types. So the big venues like the Bean Button Show or Art and Soul, they yep. don't pay your transportation. They pay you a per student, but it's a really good rate. I mean, it's a very mm-hmm. large amount, and it really only makes sense if you're teaching maybe three or four classes.
I gotcha.
And that's what I was going to say about traveling. It really only makes sense. And I will only teach for three or more days. I won't teach for less than that.
I gotcha. Once you're already there, do a few classes.
Yeah. The travel day, even though they're paying your travel, they're not paying your time. And it's exhausting to travel wherever it is you're going. In fact, in a year from now, I'm going to Australia. So that's a really exhausting trip.
Wow.
But to do that, like the Australia one, one venue isn't going to be able to support me. I mean, they can't handle my entire trip. So what we do is we combine not just one venue, but maybe two or three. So I'll kind of be doing a tour of Australia and they'll split my travel cost.
I gotcha. And you'll be there for a full week or 2 weeks or something.
I'm planning on being there for a month because I have a Ooh. Friend over there.
That's awesome.
Yeah, but I'll be over there for a longer time.
Yeah.
But what I was going to say, back to the kind of meet the teacher idea. Oftentimes, if I'm going to a place and I might be teaching, say Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, I will suggest or offer that I could also give a talk the night before if they're interested. So sometimes I will do that, and I might give a little. Talk about color or
okay.
It's kind of a way to, and a number of different positives on that. It's a way for them to actually advertise my class. So if the classes aren't completely full, my little talk that night might actually add people, like if it's a guild or something.
Oh, right.
Might add participants. Mm-hmm. It also is another, venue that I can sell some of my books or some of my materials. And sometimes I charge a very minimal fee so that it's not a huge money maker for me, but I'm already there anyway. And it's kind of like something I'm giving to them.
I gotcha.
So, you know, maybe $50, mm-hmm. I'll talk for an hour and, you know, normally my speaking fee is a little bit more than that, but
right.
in a case
okay.
like that, they're also having me teach classes, then it's something that I'm giving to them.
Okay. Okay. That's great. Yeah. So obviously you have a lot of experience with this and you know what questions to ask, you know what rates make sense for you and what things they can cover. Right. Okay.
Yes.
Okay. So can we go back and talk about your retreats that you do in Whidbey Island? I'd love to let everybody hear about those.
Oh, yeah, they're really fun. I have to go back a little bit, but my mother is a gourmet cook.
Ah.
She has always been an amazing cook. Growing up, oh, gosh, we had wonderful, wonderful meals. And I have collected all of her recipes. So when I talk about cooking, you know, a gourmet meal, it's really my mother's recipes. It's not my own recipes, but, what I'll do is my retreats right now, I offer retreats both in fiber art, Nuno felting specifically, as well as, painting. And each one of these has a huge color component. So I may, if it's a 3-day retreat, we may spend a half a day just working with color. Okay. And that's really exciting. It ends up being some of the students' favorite part of the class. Anyway, so the retreat may be 3 or 4 days. I will, cook meals. People don't stay with me, but I provide, meals through the day
and this is at your home.
And it's in my home. Yeah. Yeah. So I have a studio or a, sunroom. That's my studio. So we have, natural light on 3 walls and 90% of the time, no one ever needs a light on. It's all just natural light. It's lovely. Yeah. And it's, got views out to wetlands and then Puget Sound.
So oh, beautiful.
It's a really, really lovely place.
Yeah. Yeah. I've had the good fortune of being at one of your Whidbey Island retreats.
And you made a fabulous dessert.
Did I? I don't even remember, but when we talked,
you were an amazing baker.
I was your sous chef and helped you in the kitchen with all the meals. It was so much fun.
Yeah.
So your Whidbey Island retreats are just at such a beautiful setting. And I know when I was there, we took a break and we walked along the beach and, you know, even walking out at the beach, it's inspiring with the rocky beaches and the driftwood. It's just so beautiful.
You know, and the smells, I mean, the smell, it to me, the beach, now we're in Puget Sound. We're not, right on the ocean, but so it's calmer water, but you've still got the lapping waves. It's like all senses are tuned in. You can smell the sea. You're walking and listening to the crunching and the waves, breaking or lapping, depending on how stormy it is. It's lovely. And I actually, I have a lineup of retreats that I'm going to be doing in 2019 that have much more mindfulness component. We're going to do a lot more walking the beach and gaining inspiration. We're going to talk a lot more about how to gain color inspiration from the world around you. Just little vignettes.
Oh, I love that.
Yeah. So I'm very, very excited.
And I saw on your website, and I'll direct everyone to your website, but I think you had a date there that when your calendar would be live for 2019.
Yeah.
What is that date?
September 5th.
Okay. So September 5th, 2018, you'll be posting your calendar for the following year. Okay.
I posted the calendar, but registration
for
each of the retreats opens September 5th at 8 a.m. Pacific Coast time, so 11 o'clock your time.
Okay.
I do it that way because I have a very limited space. My Nuno felting retreats, I can only take up to 6 students. My painting, I can take up to 10. But I want to make sure that everybody kind of gets an equal share or equal ability to get a spot into their favorite retreat.
Okay.
So, yeah, open up registration at that
time. How many will you be doing in that year at Whidbey Island?
So I have a Nuno felting retreat in January and one in March. And then I have a painting retreat set up for, I believe it's July. I'm not looking at my calendar right now. I don't have any others listed because I believe that I'm going to be going to Australia in October or November, and I haven't set those dates yet.
I gotcha. Okay.
Yeah.
And Australia, you'll be doing, is this with other artists or other instructors as well, or just you?
No. Okay. And this would be fiber art, right? There's a couple of very, very, big and vibrant felting guilds and communities in Australia. And one particular reached out to me, and they have Gosh, I think every member has purchased one of my new books.
Oh, very nice.
Our belt. And so they then said, oh, come out and teach. And so I'm very excited to do that, but we haven't set the date.
Okay. Can you give the definition of Nuno Felt for our listeners, please?
Sure. So Nuno is a Japanese word meaning new cloth. And essentially, Nuno Felting, well, it was actually designed, or it was created by a woman in Australia and one in Japan in the mid-1990s. They were looking for a way to create felt that was lighter weight. So because, of course, they're in warmer Australia, can be pretty hot, and they don't want to wear wool all year. So it's a material that they create using wool fiber, wool roving, and silk or some open weave fabric. And during the felting process, the wool fiber actually works its way through the silk, through the open weave of the silk.
Okay.
And in the final processes of felting, it's called fulling, like when you throw your sweater in the dryer.
Yep.
Everything shrinks and the fibers lock up. And now all of a sudden you have this beautiful new fabric that is an amalgamation of wool and silk. And it's much lighter weight. It's very supple, gorgeous texture.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, really beautiful work. And it's, in my mind, a fabulous medium to play with color.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And is your retreat 3 to 4 days because the process takes more than one day?
No. No, I actually, well, it depends. There are projects that take multiple days. Like, there's one project that I teach that is a jacket. And
the jacket,
you can do it with no seams, no sewing. It's all done in one piece, but it takes a while to design it and to work it. Most of my retreats are actually 3 days because people are traveling sometimes from all over the world, and you want to have multiple classes that you're taking.
I gotcha.
Yeah. So I'll merge them together depending on, like maybe one of my retreats is kind of geared to people who are just trying out Nuno Felt for the first time.
Okay.
And so we might have some projects that each one of them is completed in a day. In fact, I was thinking back to a retreat a year ago that a woman actually created her shawl, and even it was still a little bit wet, but she actually wore it to an event that night.
Oh, wow.
So that's the beauty of Nuno Felt. You can start one day and that day you've got a beautiful shawl.
Oh, wow. Okay. All right.
You can see some pictures on my website of the Nuno Felting.
Great. Well, I'll get some pictures from you and we'll put it on with the links on my website.
Okay.
Let me ask you about your painting classes. When you do that and people are coming in from out of town, like if they were coming into Whidbey Island, are they painting on canvases and then they have to figure out how to get the canvas home later?
Yeah, it depends. I've had women from South Africa. I've had, from far away. And obviously, they're not going to want to take home a stretched canvas. But you can roll up. You can take it off the frame and just roll up the canvas. I do it so that you don't have to paint on a certain size. So oftentimes, if you're traveling from farther away, you want to do maybe smaller pieces.
Mm-hmm.
I also give a supply list so that people can bring their own if they want, or they can purchase all the materials from me, because I know people who are traveling, especially on an airplane, they don't want to carry anything. And some people just don't want the hassle of having to try and gather supplies.
Oh, well, so, that's great that you offer that.
Yeah, that they can just show up. And I provide everything. So I kind of offer a variety of different packages.
Okay, great, great. So what you're also offering at Whidbey Island is you're offering the whole experience of staying in a beautiful place and walking the beach, and you're providing these wonderful meals from your mother's recipes. Yeah, so that's what makes it a full retreat.
There's a lot of B&Bs and really fun hotels near me, so that's where people usually stay because they don't stay with me. I don't have a big enough place for that.
Yeah. That's great. So let me go back and talk about your books a little bit more, because we talked about Eye of Color. We talked about Beaded Colorways. And then you said you've done three more, Nuno Felt being your most recent. So what were the other two?
So the three that we've talked about are all in hard copy.
Okay.
So they're actually printed. And not print on demand, because I don't find that that quality is what I like.
Okay.
These are actual printed material. The other two are ebook form only.
Oh, okay.
So one of them is Dip into Color. And Dip into Color really was a supplement to my lectures on color, to my seminars on color. It's kind of a little bit more about, I would say, soft color theory, because it's not technical. It's all very digestible, easy to follow, and kind of fun. But it is really focused on the language of color, on how to pull color palettes together.
Okay.
And it's ebook form. One of the most popular ones is Artful Color for Creative Projects, which is also ebook form.
Mm-hmm.
And that really, what I've done is I've shown how I go from an inspiration in the world around me to create a color palette from that. And then I show a piece of artwork that I've created from that color palette. And that piece of artwork could be anything. It could be, you know, it's a mix. I have painting and beading and fiber art as well.
Okay.
That particular ebook is actually going to be used as a curriculum for a fabulous alcohol ink e-course instructor, Alexis Bonavita Cola, who is actually from Florida.
Oh, okay.
She's going to be using it in one of her classes on alcohol ink, using color, because it's just a really great resource for people wanting to try different color palettes, because we all get stuck in ruts, right?
Right.
We all start using the same colors over and over again. Mm-hmm. And it's nice to be able to break out of that, out of that rut. Yeah.
Right. Right. Yeah. You know, you say, what is your favorite color? And you say one word, one color. And really there's, you know, 6 or 7 or 10 or 12, or there's so many things that you're really attracted to, but we get so used to just saying, oh, blue, blue's my color.
And I think actually people are more attracted to color combinations than they are necessarily to a particular color, because when I, you know, if I say blue or teal, and my favorite color will change every single day. Right now it would be green, because I'm wearing green.
Okay.
I felt like green today. But if you say blue, you may, living in Florida, you may be envisioning the ocean.
Right.
But really the ocean is not one shade of blue. Right. It's blue green, and it's cobalt, and it's midnight blue, and it's all these different shades. And really, if you were to color pick, you might find 10 or 15 different colors of blue that come together in your vision of blue.
Right.
I think that's why it's so darn hard to choose wall paint. I have a really hard time with that, because I'm thinking of the beautiful greens that are out there on the leaves.
Yeah.
And yet not just one green.
Right. Right. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So, you talked about your calendar of retreats next year. So, and then you also said you've just been accepted into a gallery show. What else is new on the horizon for you?
Well, in the spirit of putting it out there so that I'm accountable.
Dun, dun, dun. Here we go.
Yeah. I am going to start teaching some e-courses.
That's wonderful.
I have to tell you that it's really funny. I have absolutely no fear of getting up in front of actual people. In fact, I'm giving a presentation for the Bellevue Art Museum in a month. That's no big deal to me.
Good.
But talking to a camera?
Oh, really?
That scared the hell out of me. Yes.
Oh, wow.
It's really funny. I have a big hurdle, and I think this is, you know, this shows my age, because definitely the younger generation does not have this hurdle.
Right.
Bless them.
Yep.
But I have a huge hurdle in talking to a camera. It doesn't, I can't read their emotion. I can't, okay. One of the things mm-hmm. I love about teaching is the connection with another person. It's watching a person's eyes that, oh yeah, they get it, or
right.
They don't, I need to change the way I'm teaching. Mm-hmm. Right.
Yep.
But a camera, I don't get that. And so I really have a fear of that. So okay. That's what I'm going to overcome.
Okay. All right. Well, I understand that. You know, I do these podcast interviews using Skype, which is a video and audio platform, but the podcast only goes out with audio. But I like to do it on video. I like to see the person I'm talking to and see the smile on their face or the non-smile and see where we're going. Yeah.
Yes. Yes. Yes.
So this, starting online courses, I mean, you've had to take photos of your artwork for your books. So you know, it might even be photos of your hands, you know, just trying to demonstrate. Yes. So you already have that, break down the steps.
Oh, yes.
You've done that for years, you know, where you need to explain it by breaking down the steps. So I think you're halfway there because you've got that. Will you be doing your own, will you be setting up a tripod and doing it for yourself, or are you going to have somebody who will be a camera person for you?
So I am going to, for the most part, yes and yes.
Yes,
I'm
okay.
For the most part, do it myself. I have researched it enough that I decided I'm going to do it on my iPhone.
Yeah.
For the first while.
A lot of people are saying that.
And I have a great little like desk setup where it's kind of like a mini tripod that enables me to angle it either towards me or to my artwork.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. When I've done my books, of course, it's still. So I have my big, huge DSLR. Yeah. That I have on a tripod behind me. I set it on a timer. I get my hands in place, right? But I can't do that video. So I've got a setup, and I'm going to do most of it myself. However, I have a teenage son who is wonderful at video. He has agreed to get me over my hump. So I think he's going to actually help me in the beginning.
Oh,
and
good.
His real gift is for post-editing.
Okay.
He just has a real great knack for that. So I'm lucky in that, hopefully he doesn't charge me too much to help me.
Well, you're still feeding him, you know, make him his favorite dessert. And that's what I would do.
No, I'm going to pay him. I'm actually going to hire him.
Oh, good. Okay.
I want this to be something that is a job for him. It's not just something he has to do for mom.
Okay.
So,
Yeah, that's great. Okay. So now I'm thinking back to what you just said about that you're going to do it with your iPhone. And I'm remembering that you do have such a strong background in photography with your DSLR. So actually maybe that is surprising that you're going iPhone.
Yeah. I teach, photography classes, but it's usually with my DSLR. In fact, I have 7 e-courses in my head that I've been trying to figure out which one to do first. I teach about using a DSLR. Basically, I call it going manual. And a lot of people with fancy cameras turn their camera onto auto.
Oh, yeah.
And take all these pictures.
Yep.
And mm-hmm. I do a walk around in my local town. 3 hours, I get them off of auto in, and at least into partial manual, if not fully manual. I have all the materials written up, and I definitely am going to turn that into some sort of e-course. It may actually not include video as much as writing and photos. Okay. It kind of depends. I'm not sure of the format for that.
Yeah.
So I have a couple of photography e-courses that are, that will be spin-offs from my classes that I teach.
Right. Yeah. So yeah. You know, the e-courses just offer something else. You know, it's just another way of getting the classes out to many people, because you've got the people who love to travel and love to go to a retreat, especially if it's an exotic location, like going to Australia. And then you've got the people who really can't afford it, or it just doesn't work in their, it doesn't fit in their work schedule. So it's a great alternative.
Yes. I've had a lot of people from, outside of the U.S. ask when I'm going to do this, because the cost is prohibitive.
That's good. Yeah. At what point do you think the average artist can offer an online course and have enough of a following that they would get the actual students in it? I mean, what do you think the milestones are that they should meet before they say, I'm going to offer this online nationally or internationally?
You know, that's a hard one, because I think it depends on a number of things. It depends on how incredible the artwork is that the person is producing. It depends on how new it is. So, for instance, when alcohol inks first hit the big market, right? Mm-hmm. The people that were right at the forefront of that could really capitalize on it. The market might be a bit difficult. Same with, acrylic pouring.
That's the hot thing. Yeah.
Sure. If you offered a class in acrylic pouring now, you're probably not going to get very many people.
And right.
Now, I believed that I could only teach a class, whatever the venue, once I created my own work that was completely different than other people. This goes back to my engineering and patenting background, where I am very conscious of other people's copyrighted materials, and I would never teach a class that was simply somebody else's class, my doing the work. So I think that is number one.
That's great advice.
You need to have your own work, your own, you can take a lot of classes and you're gaining knowledge and you're gaining techniques and you're starting to gain ideas and practicing, but it's only when you come up with your own methods and your own vision and your own body of work that I think that you could start teaching.
Okay.
And once you get to that point, then it's a matter of what venue. I think that it would really be helpful to teach in person before you tried to teach online. And that is only because you're able to understand the questions that arise of the students.
That makes sense.
Yeah. Sometimes a process that seems very easy to you is extraordinarily difficult for another person. Or perhaps you're skipping over steps and you're not teaching it the way other people are able to learn. And you learn all of that by actually teaching in person.
Right,
so,
okay.
Yeah, really, I think teaching at least for a year in person, even if it is to a bunch of your friends or your family. Just getting kind of that input is really helpful. And then beyond that, heck, I think go for it. Whatever medium you're familiar, you're comfortable with, whether it's posting videos, whether it is via a social media outlet, the blog or whatnot, or whether it is in-person workshops.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think those are the two critical things, is coming up with your own material and getting familiar with teaching.
Okay. Yeah, I think that's great. That's excellent advice. Thank you. Yeah. Well, we've touched on a lot of things. Is there anything else, anything we've missed in the world of Beverly?
I don't know. I think we did talk about a lot.
Yeah,
no, good. I can't think of anything else. But I mean, I think of a whole bunch of things. But
right.
Yeah, colors are swirling.
Right. Well, thank you so much for talking with me. This has been wonderful.
I love talking with you. Good seeing you again. And good luck to everybody out there that is looking to expand their business and their teaching and their artwork.
Oh, great. Yes. Thank you. And just say out loud the name of your website, but I'll also put that on my show notes as well as a bunch of links for the other things that we've talked about. What is your website name?
BeverlyAshGilbert.com.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the Left Brain Artist Podcast. I hope you enjoyed hearing Beverly Ash Gilbert talk about her art retreats and books and her love of color. I hope she's inspired you to consider writing a book or hosting a retreat. I've got links to some of the things we talked about in the show notes. Here are some great takeaways from this episode. Number one, partner with others and use their expertise when considering writing a book or when branding your business. Number two, take classes to learn more about the art business. Beverly took a business class from artist Kelly Ray Roberts, and she also recommends Tanya Jenny's course on how to write a book. Number three, think of your blog and classes as content for a future book. Number four, if you'd like some examples of how to write instructions for your first classes, look at the PDFs of her classes that are available on her website. Number five, when teaching far away, teach at multiple venues so they can split the cost of your travel. Number six, when students are traveling far to take classes from you, teach a few days of classes and offer a supply package for them that they can just buy from you. Number seven, consider ebooks as a publishing option for an art book. And number eight, when considering teaching an online class, be sure that your art is very good and unique and that you have taught in person for a while. I hope Beverly has gotten you thinking about how you can expand your offerings as an artist. Teaching classes at local venues are a great way to add another form of income to your business, and perhaps later you'll consider writing your own book. Thank you to Beverly Ash Gilbert for speaking to me today and sharing so many aspects of her art business. If you are enjoying these podcasts, be sure to go on iTunes and leave me a review. And thank you for listening to the Left Brain Artist Podcast. I'm Suzanne Redmond. See you next time.